Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Jordan Sava. In this episode, we're joined by Dr. Seth Wander, medical oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, to discuss the critical role of ESR1 mutations in breast cancer, including their impact on treatment decisions, the use of tissue versus liquid biopsy, and more. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Wander. To start, would you mind introducing yourself to our audience?
Right now.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you. My name is Seth Wander. I'm a medical oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and I'm also an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. So would you mind just starting by explaining the significance of ESR1 mutations in breast cancer, particularly in HR-positive metastatic breast cancer?
This is a really important question, and the field is rapidly evolving underneath our feet every month that goes by. ESR1 is the gene that encodes the estrogen receptor, and we know that if we look at primary breast cancers, meaning untreated breast cancer in the early stage setting or in the metastatic setting when there hasn't been a lot of prior therapy, that mutations in ESR1 are extremely rare, probably low single digits. But if we then watch what happens to patients over time, if the tumors become resistant to standard anti-estrogen therapy, typically an aromatase inhibitor, we see that there's an accumulation of mutations in the ESR1 gene. These mutations typically affect the ligand binding domain and allow the estrogen receptor to be constitutively active even in the absence of ligand. And that's why drugs like aromatase inhibitors, which reduce the total level of estrogen, stop working in the presence of an ESR1 mutation. So if you look at patients that have progressed, for example, on first-line metastatic therapy or second- or third-line metastatic therapy, you see a gradual increase in the frequency of ESR1 alterations, upwards of 20, 30, even 40+% in some series.
That's a great answer. Thank you so much for that. And how important is ESR1 mutation testing in clinical practice, especially in selecting treatment for patients?
Yeah, as of recently, this has become increasingly important because we now have the first FDA approval for medication based upon the presence of an ESR1 alteration. Because of the EMERALD study, we learned that the oral selective estrogen receptor degrader elacestrant is particularly effective in hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer patients that have ESR1 alterations. And because of that, it's really important for clinicians to be looking for ESR1, particularly in patients that are progressing after standard anti-estrogen therapy. So we can sequence at the time of metastatic diagnosis, but remember, if the patient hasn't had a lot of prior estrogen-directed therapy, the likelihood of detecting an ESR1 mutation there is low. And that's why it's important to then repeat testing later after progression on first and second line therapy, where you might find the acquisition of an alteration. I think more broadly speaking, what we're referring to here is the difference between a truncal mutation, a mutation that tends to occur early in the course of a disease process, and that will be present no matter kind of what time you test for it, versus an acquired alteration, which is a mutation that may not be present at the outset, but develops under selective pressure on particular drugs. And we see examples of that not only in breast cancer, but in many tumor types. And ESR1 would be a classic example of an acquired alteration.
Definitely. That's great. And thank you for bringing up the elacestrant approval. That's perfect. And at what stage of the disease do you typically recommend ESR1 testing?
I think practice patterns differ. In my own practice, I tend to sequence with next-generation targeted sequencing platform at the time of metastatic diagnosis. Now, typically, we'll have a biopsy at that time because we had to diagnose metastatic disease, and I'll send that biopsy for next-generation sequencing via solid assay, and there are many different ways to do that. Some hospitals have their own in-house testing options. Other places send it out to a variety of different companies. I will also typically do a liquid assay at that time, circulating tumor DNA. There's about an 80-ish% concordance, but sometimes you can see mutations that only occur in the liquid assay or only occur in the solid assay. Now, at that point, the patient will go on first-line therapy, and then I typically will repeat circulating tumor DNA liquid testing at the time of progression in the future, so in the second, third-line setting. I think depending on what happens with studies like SERENA-6, where we're actually looking at the acquisition of ESR1 before clinical progression, those guidelines and those recommendations might change over time. Right now, we don't really have clinical actionability for testing circulating tumor DNA on treatment in the absence of clinical progression. But again, over time, that might change as we develop newer studies prospectively looking at the emergence of these clones over time. And we can talk about SERENA-6 if you're interested. But for me, I tend to test at the beginning, solid and liquid, and then I'll repeat liquid at the time of progression. I'll repeat solid only if I have a need to do another biopsy. If I think there's been, a change in a receptor, a loss of estrogen receptor, maybe one lesion is growing while other lesions are staying stable, that might be an indication to think about another solid biopsy in the future.
Definitely. And I think it would be great to talk about SERENA-6. Would you mind just diving into a little bit about the background of that trial and potentially what the findings might do for the space moving forward?
Right. Yeah, that's a complex question. There are going to be massive editorials and things written about this in the future. So the current standard of care would suggest that we follow patients for clinical progression based upon symptoms and radiographic findings. And at the time of progression, as I mentioned, we're often repeating circulating tumor DNA or targeted sequencing and using that to make treatment decisions, whether that be targeted therapy, anti-estrogen therapy, chemotherapy, immune therapy, et cetera. SERENA-6 is a really novel design, similar to the PADA-1 study, where the patients went on first-line therapy with an aromatase inhibitor and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And then, instead of waiting for radiographic or clinical progression, the investigators were monitoring serial circulating tumor DNA biopsies for the emergence of ESR1 alterations. And in the PADA-1 study, if an ESR1 alteration arose, the patients were randomized to either continue the standard of, therapy or switch the backbone to fulvestrant from an aromatase inhibitor. And that actually conveyed really impressive, meaningful clinical benefit in that situation. And so SERENA-6 is a similar idea, except here what we're doing is we're taking patients on aromatase inhibitor and CDK inhibitor. We're watching for the emergence of ESR1. If that occurs, but there's no clinical or radiographic progression, the patients are randomized to continue the current, standard of care or transition to an oral selective estrogen receptor degrader, camizestrant, which again has the potential to be particularly effective against the ESR1 variant. And that study is actively accruing right now. And to answer the second part of your question, if that study is positive, it'll depend a little bit on how positive it is. If it shows a really large, impactful clinical benefit, I think it does have the potential to change our approach to monitoring these patients and to realize that identifying subclonal emergence of these type of targetable alterations before there's overt clinical radiographic progression, it might pay dividends to change their therapy in that setting. And you could imagine the implications of that, not just for breast cancer, but across the design of clinical trials for many different solid tumors where there's a targetable alteration that might be intervened upon earlier.
Yeah, that's a really great answer in addition to the conversation. So thank you so much for diving into that. And then just jumping back to ctDNA a little bit more, what are the pros and cons of detecting ESR1 mutations via tissue biopsy versus liquid biopsy?
This is an important question across the board, not just for ESR1. And I think the traditional approach, solid tumor biopsy, targeted sequencing assay versus these newer liquid assays, there are strengths and weaknesses to both of them. Of course, the downside of a solid tumor biopsy is that it's more invasive. It's more difficult for the patient. There's risk of injury, infection, bleeding, et cetera. The other downside of a solid tumor biopsy is you're only looking at that area, right? You're only looking at the tumor DNA landscape in the area and in the cancer cells that you're biopsying. The advantage of the liquid biopsy is that you're able to get a less invasive or minimally invasive assessment without having to put the patient through, IR or surgical procedures. And you're sampling kind of the entire tumor ecosystem. So any area throughout the body where there's tumor cells that are shedding DNA into the blood could be sampled via that liquid assay. Now, the sensitivity of that for particular gene depends on how much tumor is present, what the purity of the sample is, et cetera. So sometimes you can get a better sample by doing a solid tumor biopsy, depending on how much disease might be present. And of course, the downside to the liquid biopsy is if there's an area of malignancy where there's not DNA being shed into the blood, you might get a false negative in that scenario. So there are ways where you can have DNA alterations that are seen on solid but not on liquid, or vice versa, where it's seen on liquid but not on solid. And then, of course, most of the time you'll detect things on both, as we mentioned earlier.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And when interpreting ESR1 mutations in the clinical setting, how do you explain the concept of variant allele frequency or VAF to oncologists who might be unfamiliar?
When you're reading a report from next generation sequencing assay, whether that's on a solid sample or on a liquid sample, you're looking at, again, a large number of cancer cells, and you're taking a large number of DNA reads from every site that's being tested. So when you read these reports, the first thing you want to look at is what are the mutations, right? What genes have alterations? And then the second thing you want to look at is what kind of alteration is it? And there are different ways to answer that question. The type of alteration, it could be a single nucleotide variant. It could be a copy number change, meaning more copies or fewer copies. It could be something like a translocation, right, where two pieces of the DNA are broken apart and brought back together. And then the third thing you want to look at is the variant allele frequency. So for those mutations that are identified either in the solid tumor or in the blood, they'll give you an estimate of the number of samples done at that DNA location, how many have the alteration versus how many don't. The concept being the higher the variant allele frequency, the more of the tumor cells' DNA samples have that alteration. The clinical utility of that is somewhat debatable for a few reasons. There isn't great standardization across the different tests as to what the cutoff should be to call an alteration on a specific variant allele frequency. You might see very, very rare alterations. Those could be rare because they actually truly are rare, or it could be rare because of sampling, right? That there are different areas that aren't shedding as much into the blood. The variant allele frequency can be impacted both by the methodology that's being used as well as the tumor purity in the sample. And so I think we have to take it with a grain of salt. It's not so much that we can make a lot of clinical decisions today based on the variant allele frequency, but it can be helpful to give you a sense, certainly, of change over time. If you have serial samples in the same patient, either on treatment or off treatment, and you see a variant allele frequency rising or falling, again, it might tell you something about the clonal dynamics of that tumor, which cell population, which mutational population is on the rise or is responding to therapy. And if the variant allele frequency starts to approach a number, around 50%, you might be thinking, okay, this might be a germline alteration. Now, remember, those targeted sequencing assays are not meant to test germline. So you'd have to, connect with the genetic counseling team and do an appropriate sort of CLIA-approved germline test. But that can be a hint, if you don't already have germline testing, that maybe there's something going on there that requires confirmatory testing.
That's great. And right off of that, many oncologists face challenges in understanding the clinical significance of different VAF levels. So could you just clarify how oncologists should interpret low versus high VAF in ctDNA and if that influences treatment decisions?
I'll take the second part of the question first. At the moment, I don't think it really significantly influences treatment decisions because, as I said, there are a number of factors that can influence the VAF or the variant allele frequency. I think clinicians really want to look at presence or absence of specific alterations, and they want to have a sense of whether that variant allele frequency is very high, right, where you're starting to think that half of the cells in the body or half of the cancer cells might have that alteration, versus on the lower end, where it might be an acquired alteration, like we just talked about, something that wasn't there from the beginning, but is now starting to emerge under selective pressure. I wouldn't necessarily use the variant allele frequency to choose between targeted agents because, again, there are a lot of factors that can influence what that number is. I think the decision about which agent to use, if you have multiple targeted findings on sequencing, is based on what therapies the patients had before. It's based on which specific type of mutation is present. Obviously, you want something that's likely to be pathogenic or activating, as opposed to something called a VUS or variant of uncertain significance or a benign variant that's not likely to be altering the gene in any pathogenic way. And also has to do with the side effect profile of the drug, the patient's medical comorbidities, what type of therapy they might be interested in. So I think those are the factors in the presence of a specific mutation that should guide therapeutic planning. Not to say that the VAF isn't important. It is one piece of information. And I think we have to continue to refine the technology and to refine some of our prospective and retrospective studies to better inform how to use the VAF itself to start to integrate into the decision-making process.
Great. And what does a higher VAF mean for endocrine therapy resistance? And how does that affect treatment strategies, if in any way?
I think it would depend on the gene. Again, if you have good purity in the sample, and if you're seeing a specific variant allele that's rising over time, what that might suggest is that that population of genetically altered cancer cells is increasing in terms of its overall fraction of the tumor population. So one could imagine, for example, in thinking about the example of PADA1 or SERENA6, if you have a person who didn't have an ESR1 mutation, and then they're on therapy, and then you see a very small variant allelic fraction pop up, and then a little bit later you see it rising even further, that might be a suggestion that you have a subclone that's emerging, that's starting to grow, and will eventually become the dominant tumor population, if allowed to. Again, that has to be interpreted in the context of what sort of assay you're using, what other genomic alterations are present, what the tumor purity is, et cetera. But just philosophically and biologically speaking, something that's not there, present at a low number, and then rising, rising, rising over time would suggest that you have a population that's sort of emerging and growing, on whatever therapy or treatment you're giving the patient.
Thank you for that. And moving right along, just how do you use ctDNA to monitor disease progression or treatment response in your patients with breast cancer? Do you think it can replace imaging or serve as an adjunct to traditional monitoring methods?
I hope so in the future. At the moment, right now, we don't have any standard guideline-based or really robust prospective data to help us here. Of course, we have PADA1 experience that I just mentioned. We have the SERENA-6 experience coming. At the moment, I'm using all the tools that we're used to using. So we're using serial cross-sectional imaging studies, whether that be CT, bone scan, PET scan. Now we have FES PET imaging that looks specifically at estrogen receptor activity. We're using clinical exam. We're using tumor markers, right? Traditional tumor markers. I have not routinely integrated circulating tumor DNA while someone's doing well on treatment. But I suspect in the future that that actually is going to become a really important tool. Circulating tumor DNA can give you lots of information. It can give you information about the sort of total amount of tumor DNA, in the body or across the tumor ecosystem. And of course, as that rises over time, you might suspect there may be more cancer cells, right, present. So it's a it should serve, as a marker of overall disease activity. And then, of course, you're looking, as we just talked about, at those specific subclones of mutations that are rising and falling over time. So, in the future, as we have studies like PADA1, studies like SERENA-6, in a prospective way where we're monitoring this on treatment, I do think it will help us understand what's happening before radiographic progression, before clinical symptoms occur. Does that mean it's going to replace traditional imaging and these other tools? I don't think so in the short term. Do I think it will emerge as a really important adjunctive tool that we can use? Absolutely. And I think over time, the relative value of all of those tools, right? Obviously, you have exam, you have routine laboratory studies and tumor markers, you have all the imaging and the newer imaging modalities we have, and the circulating tumor assays and the informed tumor assays, things like Signatera, minimal residual disease monitoring. All of these things are going to enter our arsenal to use, both in the early stage and in the metastatic setting. And I think these are, the very early days of how that technology is eventually going to evolve into our clinical practice. And I can imagine a future where we're using some of these genomic tools, both to detect new mutations and to, in a very sensitive way, detect emergence of the specific cancer population that we're trying to monitor. I think that we're going to have great opportunities to use those tools in the future, not just for breast cancer, but for all types of malignancy.
Perfect. And we're wondering just have you seen differences between tissue and ctDNA results for ESR1? And how should oncologists choose between the two of them?
Yes, you can. As I mentioned, there are discrepancies between the two of them, and that's not just for ESR1, that's for any genomic alteration that you're looking for. There's concordance the majority of the time, but there may be discordance for the reasons we had previously discussed. The FDA approval for EL assessment was based upon circulating tumor DNA assay for ESR1. So many of the guidelines now would suggest using circulating tumor DNA assay for the reasons we had spoken about, being it's less invasive and it does a better job of sampling the entire tumor ecosystem rather than biopsying a specific focus. I think the fear is if you biopsy one site and you have a negative ESR1, it may be sampling error, right? It may be a false negative if there are other tumor populations present that have the alteration. So I'm typically using circulating tumor DNA, particularly as related to ESR1, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a role sometimes for biopsy and for using solid tumor assay as well. And of course, in breast cancer, we still need these biopsies so that we can detect ER, PR, HER2, PD-L1 in triple negative situations, HER2 IHC as we're trying to decide whether we want to use something like trastuzumab deruxtecan. So it's not that one can be replaced by the other, but they do potentially provide mutually exclusive information in some situations.
What are the key resistance mechanisms associated with the newer treatments targeting ESR1?
Great question. We don't know. This is a key question. So we know that ESR1 itself is a key resistance mechanism to many of the earlier generation anti-estrogens, particularly the aromatase inhibitors. What we're really looking at now is developing a better appreciation for the concept that it's not a binary ESR1 mutant versus wild type. Like any molecular change, there are different kinds of ESR1 mutations, and they can have different functions within the tumor cell. And so not all ESR1 mutations are made alike. Some of them may be particularly resistant to certain drugs, some of them may be particularly sensitive to certain drugs, and some patients might have more than one ESR1 mutation. That's what we call polyclonality. So one patient might have a single alteration, one patient might have two or three, one patient might have five, 10 or more. And we're starting to develop research efforts and programs to look at that diversity of those mutations and start to determine what the relationship is to treatment response to currently available drugs, as well as drugs that are under active development, like next generation antiestrogens. You have oral SERDs, you have proteolysis targeting chimeras, you have selective estrogen receptor modulators, you have complete estrogen receptor antagonists, right? All of which may have slightly different activities with different kinds of ESR1 mutants, or patients that have ESR1 mutation plus X, plus PI3 kinase, plus RAS, plus RB. And so we need to be thinking at that level. We need to be thinking not just about ESR1 as a binary yes, no, but of the different personalized patterns of ESR1 alterations, because as these newer drugs move farther through clinical trials and eventually enter regular practice, we need to be able to help clinicians choose in the most personal way possible which combination of drugs might be best for which patient. And your question of, in the presence of ESR1, once we use one of these newer drugs, what then causes resistance to that? I think that's the frontier, right? That's what we're also going to be starting to look at. Is it RAS pathway? Is it AKT, PI3 kinase pathway? Is it something totally different that we haven't yet identified? Those efforts are only now just beginning as we get data back from the first generation of these newer anti-estrogen agents.
That's excellent. Thank you so much for that. And that's very exciting. It's crazy to see how much is coming out. I guess just what are the main challenges community oncologists face in using ESR1 testing in ctDNA?
Yeah, it's well, the field is moving so fast, and that's true for all different cancer types. So it's such a challenge to keep up with all these newer therapies and all these newer diagnostic tools. So I'm constantly amazed by our partners in the community who are able to move from one room to the other, seeing all different kinds of tumor types and knowing everything that's going on with all of them. I think in particular with ESR1 alterations, I think the challenge here is to remember, to think about sequencing after progression, right? Just because you've banked a molecular or genomic assay at the time of metastatic diagnosis, or earlier in the patient's disease course, if it's ESR1 wild type, it would be worth retesting again later on. And in the future, and this is a good problem to have, the challenge is going to be that we have multiple drugs potentially approved. Right now, we have one drug approved, but there are many other agents in phase three trials. And if we start getting positive results from some of these other agents, there may be multiple choices, just like we had multiple CDK4/6 inhibitors and multiple aromatase inhibitors. And we're going to need to work with our partners in academia, in industry, and in the community to help decide amongst all of these potentially exciting choices which drug would be the right choice for which patient. And I think that's going to be the kind of new challenge that arises as we do more and more molecular testing. We see more and more patterns of these are one, alterations. We have newer agents that are available, both alone and hopefully soon in combination with targeted therapies. How do we choose which drug, which combination for which patient? I think that's where we really need to be focusing our effort right now, and that's what we're doing.
Definitely. No, that's perfect. And to kind of conclude our conversation, what advancements in ESR1 research do you find most promising for the future of breast cancer treatment?
So many great and exciting answers to that. I am incredibly enthusiastic about these new classes of drugs that are under active clinical development, and I think we are working, very diligently to think about the best combinations, to think about from this new menu of next generation anti-estrogen agents and this constantly enlarging menu of targeted therapy options. Next generation CDK inhibitors, next generation PI3 kinase AKT inhibitors, RAS pathway inhibitors, and we have other new things like KAT6 inhibitors, new antibody drug conjugates. I'm incredibly enthusiastic that our menu of options is going to continue to expand almost at log scale. And so the thing I'm most excited about is trying to pair that clinical development effort with translational research genomic efforts, where we're looking at biopsy samples, we're looking at liquid and solid biopsies before treatment, on treatment, after treatment, to understand who are the patients that are doing particularly well with this strategy or that strategy? Who are the patients that might be better served with this approach or with that approach? If we continue to remain focused on the importance of translational medicine, we'll be able to develop a really personalized understanding of who should be getting what treatment. And so I'm really enthusiastic about the commitment to that effort across academia and across industry. And the more we stay focused on that as we develop all these new therapeutic tools, I think the better we're going to be able to deliver care to patients with less toxicity and more likelihood of success.
Amazing. Thank you so much for all of the comprehensive answers. That was perfect. And is there anything that I missed or anything that you'd like to add, or maybe any last pieces of advice that you'd want our audience to take away?
No, I think you're asking all the right questions, and I think this is an incredibly exciting time. We've had so many new FDA approvals for both early stage and metastatic breast cancer just over the last 3 to 5 years, and I think we really want to keep our eye as a field on these broad classes of drugs, and then also what some of the newer technologies are. We've been talking a lot today about primarily targeted sequencing of solid and liquid biopsies. Remember, we have lots of other exciting new technologies coming, right? We have methylation profiling, epigenetic profiling, RNA profiling, proteomic, level profiling. So all of those tools will also afford new opportunities to understand response and resistance to drugs. And the most important thing is to stay focused on how we take those efforts between the clinic and the lab, and we use them to deliver good, insightful, actionable pieces of information for all oncologists, right, across the country, no matter what clinical setting they're in.